Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dave Deptula, Dean of the Mitchell Institute, and welcome to Aerospace Nation. Today, the Air Force is in the middle of a force design effort to prepare it for an era of sustained great power competition. Now, that touches on everything from strategy, concepts of operation, weapon systems, personnel, and others. Future battle space will differ from what we experienced over the last 30 plus years in Iraq and Afghanistan. Future adversaries are destined to be much more challenging. The Air Force recognizes that and is moving aggressively to devise and implement ways and means to deter conflict and to ensure we can fight and win if necessary to do so. The key leader in this effort is Lieutenant General Dave Harris, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Air Force Futures. Dave, thanks so much for being here today. We're really looking forward to what you have to say. And so let's kick off by giving you the opportunity to give us a bit of an overview on the challenges that you face and how you're meeting.
Hey, Dave, good morning. It's great to be here. And thanks for inviting me back again, especially after some of the last interviews. But I will tell you, I'm excited to be here and talk a little bit about what's going on in the environment and more specifically what's going on in Air Force Futures. So if I could just jump in real quick and talk a little bit about what we're doing in the work going on in our future force design. I think it would be helpful context as we get into the questions onto this one.
Sounds great.
So the future force design, I don't know if we've ever had one before, maybe before World War II, as we were the Air War Plans Division, trying to get ready for before World War II. But right now, the way that we look at force design, there has to be a North Star or a guiding light to talk about and face and address those threats that you just mentioned. So from my point of view, we take a look at force design, and we look at three things. We look at homeland defense, we look at strategic deterrence, and we look at power projection. So from those three views, we have different lenses. So the first one that everybody thinks of is capabilities. What are the platforms? How many munitions? All those types of things. But there's another important lens, and that's the people side of this house. And that is making sure that we have the right people trained and ready to make sure that we can have those capabilities relevant at a timely matching of both people and capability coming online. The last part, and it's a little counterintuitive, but where we put those people and where we put those capabilities matter, the posture piece of it. There was a point in time when we started looking at shifting bases around and moving mission around. Well, what mission gets where is also equally important. So that's probably the third leg of the force design that I think is really important. And it also speaks to a little bit of some of the transformation and reoptimization that's going on today to meet that future threat.
Well, very good. Appreciate that. It's a great intro.
Thanks.
Let's jump into some of the questions out there. Now, Lieutenant General Moore was just over here on Monday, and he kind of reiterated and confirmed that the Air Force is the smallest it's ever been, and it's going to continue to get even smaller. Obviously, it was dramatically cut after the Cold War, and the cuts kept on coming. However, today's threat environment continues to demand more air power than currently available. And the reason for that is it's the essential ingredient to virtually every combatant commander. So how do these two sort of opposing realities impact your work at Futures?
Yeah, good question. And definitely it's something that we think about a lot. So as far as the capabilities and where we're going, I would offer maybe to tweak Rick's point a little bit. It's the right capabilities and the right capacity of those capabilities that we need. And quite frankly, that's all driven by the threat. So when you look at the threat and you're seeing where the where the trends are going into this, you can go one of two ways. One is you can start matching fighter squadron per fighter squadron to the adversary, and you can get into this attrition mindset, or you can make sure that you have the right capabilities and try to make sure that we take a maneuver approach to this. So how do we square that corner? When I said before that we look at the right capabilities with the right people and the right training, we've run scenario after scenario. And you know, having worked with you over the years, that we've got about 6 years of studies and analysis and wargaming to kind of show us what those capabilities are. So I think investments in the right areas are probably the first and foremost the key to this. Second is taking a look at the current inventory we have. And going back to some other conversations we've had, you know, it doesn't take a whole new clean sheet fighter or a whole new clean sheet bomber. You can take a lot of the inventory we have today, upgrade it to make sure that it's compatible for the future threat.
Sure. Oh, thanks for that. Let me give a bit of a follow-on.
Sure.
You know, to this end, Congress and the public deserve an honest assessment of what the Air Force requires to actually accomplish the National Defense Strategy. And there comes a point, and you're well aware of this, where innovation can only take us so far, and capacity and trained personnel, in addition to the capability pieces you speak about, are needed to accomplish our missions. So what are your thoughts on where we are in defining the difference between what we have and what we need?
So what we have and what we need, I will be the first one to tell you that, or maybe I'm not the first, maybe the third person to tell you, we need more Air Force. But outside of that, I also understand that there's other competing priorities within DOD. Not only that, there's other national priorities that the president is trying to balance right now. So we're a piece of this. But when we look at those capacities and those capabilities, to Rick's point, it is the smallest Air Force we've had in a long time. To your innovation point of this, I disagree a little bit, and I'll push back. And the reason why I'll push back is it's really our airmen. They are the innovators. They are the reason and the key ingredient. I mean, we're Americans. This is what we can do. And we can innovate. We've seen it in every single conflict that we've been in. And if you unleash that innovative spirit and then match that with the right industrial capacity, you can really start getting some good asymmetric advantages coming to this. But it really requires our people to have a good in-depth understanding of what that threat is and where we're going.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with that point. But the point I was trying to make is at some point numbers matter. We've had a 2,000 pilot shortfall now for 10 years. And if we get into a dust-up or a conflict and we start losing people and we don't have them to replace, it gets to be an ugly picture real quick, as you're well aware. What happened to the Luftwaffe in World War II is they didn't run out of airplanes, they ran out of pilots. So you're exactly right on the people thing. They matter, but we need enough of them. So that's basically the only point.
So we do. But I would also argue that when you go to the innovative spirit, that maybe what I don't trade is a person for a person, but a munition for a person or a platform for a person. And this is going back to the unmanned piece of this as well.
Oh, yeah.
So when we start thinking about this holistically, I can't get back in. I don't want to get back into the attrition warfare mindset.
Yeah. No, well, that's a good point. But we could also talk about munitions and how we're doing in our munitions.
Yes, we can. Yes.
Okay. Cost per effect, given that insufficient budgets are barring the delivery of air power demand, it's crucial that we make the most out of every dollar that we do have. And one way of assessing that is cost per effect. In other words, looking at the resources it takes to net a desired outcome or effect. To that end, sort of carrying on to our last exchange, it's a lot cheaper to use a precision munition coming off a single aircraft to take down a target than over a dozen aircraft that are using dumb bombs or unguided munitions. What is often the cheapest unit cost is oftentimes the more expensive enterprise solution. So how do you and your team factor in these realities when working the force design ideas that you have?
Yeah, so I'm with you on the cost per effect. And I think for a while there, we had that out of balance for many years looking at, but we have an opportunity now with the force design to look at it different. So cost per effect and your comment about precision is interesting because, you know, you've seen that chart which shows precision versus accuracy, right? And I think you need both. It's not just precision. You can be precisely hitting the wrong target sometimes. So there's information onto this that we need. So this is where I believe in the force design that we're starting to go down this path of a high-low mix. And that is you need a certain amount of precision and you need a certain amount of low-cost munitions because what I need to understand is the threat environment. General Alvin talks about this as the changing character of war. And this is just us recognizing that the adversary is putting things in place to do exactly what you just said and stop our ability to be precise and accurate at the same time. So my job is to find out new creative ways to make sure that that precision and accuracy come together at the right time and space and then still get the right return on investment. I think there's a high-low mix discussion within this munitions that we need to talk about as well.
No, and that's a great point. It reminds me in terms of targeting. Getting down maybe into the tactical level weeds, there are some target sets that you want dispersed and area coverage munitions, which you don't necessarily need nor want that very specific high accuracy
Agree.
Capability.
Agree.
Now, the Air Force could really benefit, I think, in addition to what we've been talking about, but to a force sizing methodology that readily translates to Congress as well as the American public at large, the number of different types of aircraft that the Air Force needs to meet the demands of our national defense strategy. Are you looking into this? And if so, what are the status? What's the status of the effort?
We are, as a matter of fact. I think that's foundational to being able to make sure that, one, that we have the right force capable of doing the right things. And we've said before, you get one budget, you have one Air Force to be able to do multiple missions against multiple threats. So what are we doing about the force sizing construct? We've talked before about, you know, the ATF was a fantastic way of being able to know that you're going to have X amount of bombers and X amount of fighters with X amount of platforms within one unit, deployable unit, to be able to go fight a war. And we need X number of units to be able to, right, to meet the needs of what we're being asked to do. So in this vein, with great power competition and the reoptimization efforts that are going on, we're looking at the deployed combat wing. So similar, but not exactly the same as the ATF construct on this, because there's aspects of maneuver, there's aspects of force protection. There's new threats that are facing us today. We've talked before about some of the cyber threats.
Right.
You can't assume anymore that you have sanctuary back in the homeland, which is why that's a part of the force design. There's continual cyber presence and bad cyber actors that are out there. There's also going to be things that we need to take into account when we go forward by way of sustainment. So all of that together gives us a different construct that we have to organize around. And then from that construct, the deployable combat wing, we now know in order to meet the demands of the nation, again, we can make that force sizing construct work. It has to be simple. Like you said, we have to be able to talk to Congress about this in a way that I need X number of deployable combat wings to be effective in the fight. And if the threats continue to increase, more deployable combat wings with the right capabilities in them matter.
Yeah, very good. Now, switching gears just a little bit, we've long known that the Air Force needs to pursue a new generation of both air-to-air and air-to-ground munitions. Buying fifth and sixth gen aircraft, but only possessing third generation munitions to equip them seems to be a real challenge. Could you share with us a bit what you'd like to see happen with respect to munitions?
Munitions, absolutely. Yeah. So we talked a little bit about it, and so from my point of view, there's a level of exquisite munition that we need, and there's a level of the low-cost munition that we need, and that mix is critically important. So you talked about the 5th gen, 6th gen launching 3rd gen munitions. Well, if those 5th and 6th gen can get to the target, and I can get a lower cost per effect on a 3rd gen munition, I'm just going to use what works at the end of the day. But if I can't make it to the target with my 5th and 6th gen, then I need the more sophisticated munitions.
That's a great point.
So I think really there has to be this pairing of it. I can't look at it in isolation.
Yep. Very good. You mentioned or alluded to base defense. Everyone's pretty aware nowadays that our forward bases are vulnerable to attack. So we have to focus a little bit more than we have in the past on effective base defense. What's your take on this from a roles and missions perspective, as well as a technical requirements vantage point? In other words, what's the state of development out there for air-based defense? And if you could, you know, there's been a promise of directed energy. You know, where is that in terms of its potential?
Sure. Sure. So good point about the forward bases being contested. It's exactly what we were just talking about. They're going to be contested in multiple ways. It's not just from the high-end ballistic missiles, but your cruise missiles as well as your cyber attacks. So there is a range now of base defense and almost redefining what it is that we have to protect ourselves against. So from that lens, I look at it and I say that one piece of this, some of the lower cost pieces, is the concept of agile combat employment and how we're going to move about and be able to kind of create the pulses that we need to be effective in that fight. But you can't create the pulses you need without an incredible and effective base defense platform what's in there. So just looking at DoD in general, you know, the Army has a role into the protecting the joint force with missile defense, but the Air Force does as well. And the Air Force still has to provide offensive and defensive capabilities for its ability to be able to provide air superiority for this piece. So I think both of these are actually not in contention with each other, but we have to overlap these to make sure that we have the right amount of it. Because quite frankly, I would rather be offensive in nature than defensive, but there's a time I need to be defensive. You can go back to World War II. Nothing has changed since then in my mind. And when you look at some of the islands that are out there, there's three things that they needed to have happen. One was a credible and effective C2 mechanism to know where the threat was and be able to communicate. The other one is they needed base defense onto there. So we would launch a fighter. It would go up. It would look for contrails or it would look for wakes and it would radio back, hey, I found something and it's inbound. And from that point, you would reload the planes on the ground with either air-to-air or air-to-ground or air-to-ship munitions onto this. And then as the enemy was advancing, they would use AAA pieces to be able to hold it off just to be able to get the fighters to launch, to be able to go do its mission. Nothing's changed. We still have to do the same thing. We just have better technology to do it. And we have rapid speeds in which we have to effectively get in inside that OODA loop on it.
Yeah. Very good. Well, whether we look at the base defense mission or collaborative teaming at the forward edge of the battle space, information's role is absolutely crucial. In that regard, where do we stand on advanced battle management system? And when are we going to start seeing actual capability enter into the force?
Yeah, so the ABMS piece is kind of the backbone in which we're going to, I just talked about the C2 piece of this. How do you effectively communicate from one location to another location and then back to some of your higher echelons of command? And that's going to be the architecture that we see. And that's being put into place today. We have Brigadier General Luke Cropsey and Brigadier General Flack Clayton. And the beauty between those guys and how they work is one works the requirements and concept side of the house. The other works the acquisition and sustainment piece. And if you want to look at traditional roles, they stay in those lanes, but they don't. They overlap into how they integrate together. And what that does is it creates an accelerant, and it's actually putting us on a much faster path than we were before. But you can't just look at the Air Force alone to do this. This is going to be a joint fight. It's going to be with allies and partners. So understanding what's out there in the environment, I think, is what took us a little while to get to where we are. And then the other part of that is where now can we place those bets and the investments that we need to make sure that we have a resilient architecture that hits the whole joint force into this to include space. Now, let me go back real quick because I'd never answered your high energy laser weapon. There is a place for directed energy, quite frankly, I believe, into this. You look at the magazine depths on these things, and it's something you can recharge, and there's an elegance to that. I think what we need to do is get technology and place money into the S&T account to make sure that we can get this capability up to where there's the increase, there's a decreased time between shots, and I'm more effective with more power onto those as well. So I don't think it's not a one-hit wonder that's going to solve all of our base defense needs for us, but is it a part of the base defense architecture? Absolutely, it should be.
Yeah, and then there's the weather piece,
and too. The weather, and absolutely.
Attenuation,
you bet.
Challenges that we have, which just as an aside, and you know, the Air Force recently made the decision to take the laser off of the C-130 that they were planning. Any insights you can provide on that?
No, I don't have any insights on that. But I will tell you that it's an interesting proposition because, you know, we used to have the airborne laser and the program there. But I think if you think about using that differently, there's a lot of value proposition. When you talk about your return on investment and what you can get out of that, I think we're getting to a point with tech maturation where we might be able to revisit this and look at options that we might be able to put on multiple platforms, even uncrewed platforms or unmanned platforms as well.
No, for years I used to talk about, still do, it's still valid. We've become used to employing effects at the speed of sound. You start to employ effects at the speed of light, that really can be game-changing.
Agreed.
Which is a term people tend to overuse, but maybe one day we'll get there. Air superiority, for those of us in our audience, you know this, but by definition, is control of the air at a given time and place, and is transitory. While air supremacy is a condition where an opposing force is incapable of interfering anywhere in an operational area. I think the distinction between the two is very important, but it's often confused. The bottom line is that both provide joint forces the freedom from attack, the freedom to attack, and without one or the other, we lose, period, dot. So as you look to the future operating environment, are we investing sufficiently in this critical mission area?
I believe so. And when I say I believe so, I have to look at multi-domain because there's a quote that's out as soon as you come up through the doors of the Mitchell Institute from General Welsh, and it says, air superiority, without it, you lose. We all agree with that. And I think you can see the effects of that today in the Russia-Ukraine conflict as well. So there's lots of lessons learned and lessons relearned and observed that kind of point to this direction. But the way that we think about air superiority has to be broadened now just because of the integration that we're seeing between air, sea, land, cyber, space, all of these coming together, that your typical 1v1 or multi-v-multi air superiority fighters trying to create that air corridor for you, I think is a very not old way of thinking, but I think we have to look at it differently. There's an interesting concept here about what we're seeing that's unfolding with some of these low-cost UAVs. And I wonder if there's an air superiority piece that looks at maybe 5,000 feet and below, and you can see some of the effects that we're seeing right now and how credible that threat is with these one-way UAV attacks that are coming in. And then how do you defend against that? Is that an air-based air defense problem, or is that an air superiority problem? Because they are denying you freedom of movement, like your definition says, about where we need to be in the battle space. So it's a layered approach that we have to take on to this. It's not just a fighter. It's multiple systems coming together at the right time and space to be able to create that corridor of freedom of maneuver for you.
Well, I think you're exactly right, particularly with respect to the integration of a variety of different elements. And, you know, whether it's air defense and ground-based air defenses, whether it's, you know, airborne interceptors, whether it's drones, whether it's cyber, all of these things have a piece in that, in getting to that desired end state of either air superiority or air supremacy.
But it's going to get more contested in the future. And this is the area where we need to pay attention on where that threat trend is going, to be able to put more investment in the right areas of that equation of air superiority.
Which is a nice segue into my next question, which is all about artificial intelligence, which is obviously going to have a major impact on future combat ops, not just in what we were just talking about, but in all aspects. So what are the metrics that you're using to assess where and when and if we should apply it?
So great question, because I literally just got back from MIT's AI Accelerator just earlier this week, looking at where they're helping Air Force futures out into using artificial intelligence. The first place that we're looking at it is within our wargaming methodology, and that is being able to have thousands of runs using either an automated assistant or using somebody that's a knowledge assistant, even something as simple as rapid adjudication in some of these games. So instead of just getting three turns against an adversary, I can run thousands of iterations in one turn to understand what some of the optimal solutions are of, hey, maybe if you placed your force up into the northern sector versus the southern, it created a different opportunity. Yeah. And understanding some of that trade space is, I think, where AI is going to be able to help us out a lot. There's another piece of the visit that we did up at MIT, and there's an interesting connection here between humans operating aircraft and then just being fully autonomous. There's a piece in the middle with the human machine teaming piece of this. And this speaks to a point where when we start looking at, hey, if a pilot is flying with unmanned aircraft around it, what is the connection between those two? As the pilot begins to fatigue after a long flight, can we recognize this and then have that platform go more into an autonomous mode versus, hey, the pilot's at peak performance and now I can probably control and maneuver these a bit more? That intersection is an area that's being explored. And I think it's an important one as it relates to the force design and where we go.
No, that's great. Again, nice evolution into my next question, which basically centers around this whole notion of collaborative combat aircraft. And Futures has been a key voice in charting just how CCAs are going to be incorporated into con ops as well as the reality of the force. And as with most forms of technology, we're most likely going to see and have already heard taken a qual, walk, run type of evolution. So how do you see and can you speak to CCAs and how we're going to incorporate those as we move into the near-term future?
So I think the wrong way to incorporate them is put what we think is a final end state product out to the user for them to just say, okay, now take this and adapt it into your TTPs. I think the way that this is going to have to end up evolving is we get something on the ramp, and when we allow the operator to start working with this to understand what the left and right limits are, and then begin to bound what we want that collaborative combat aircraft to do. So that's step one. We tend to focus a lot on the materiel piece of this, but there is so much more baked into the doctrine, the TTPs, the manpower piece of CCAs. All those things have to be thought through. So I would offer that the crawl, walk, run phase that we're doing, we still want to get quantities out to the field, but we want to get them out and use them the right way and learn from them, and then be able to start integrating properly and evolve. That's right.
No, that's very good. Now, Futures isn't just focused on force application. Mobility is an essential mission as well. And I know, and there's a lot of work being done on next generation refueling concepts, sustaining distributed operating locations, and protecting larger mobility type aircraft. Could you talk a little bit about the mobility mission area and its importance?
I can. I think that General Minahan could probably say it better than I could, but I don't think we can look at mobility in the traditional sense of mobility anymore. I think it's going to have to be baked in across multiple mission sets of what we do in the Air Force in the future. So as the guy that's looking at the future force, it's no longer just refueling, and it's no longer just airlift. It's going to be things that are blended capabilities together for C2, part of that ABMS architecture that we talked about. We're looking at things about where we can actually put it. The Mobility Guardian exercise that was just run was a great vignette and a great exercise for us to really understand what does it take to be able to get out of town on a timely basis. How much can we actually apply within the theater? And you know, from a tactical level, we're seeing some interesting developments coming into the mobility and tanker fleet. But at the operational level as well, what decisions do we need made, and what decisions do we need to flow back, and how can we start integrating the mobility air forces into that role? At the strategic level, it's getting TRANSCOM, INDOPACOM, STRATCOM, and all these other issues out on the table and figuring out where the tension points are to be able to work through those. So more of those types of exercises, I think, are going to be needed in the future. That's also going to help us actually look at what we think the next generation air refueling system is going to be, or the next generation air logistics system is going to be. We always talk about a family of systems. I'm here to tell you families are expensive. But so when you talk about the how much can we afford of things, I would also go back to say how much do we need to be effective? And that comes back into maybe there are a few of these things that some have a niche capability, others have a very broad applicability to the joint force.
Well, listen, thanks very much for a really wonderful overview of all the things that you're doing and the innovative ideas that you're putting into play. What we're going to do now is open up the session to questions from the audience. And you all out there know the drill. So when I call on you, if you do raise your hand, unmute your mic, and please state your name and affiliation before asking your question. While we're waiting for folks to, we already have one, so I don't need to wait. Let me just call on Mark Kennedy. Mark, you've got it.
Thank you. Appreciated the question on next generation munitions, but we really didn't talk about where do we stand on having something with the range that can compete with what China is facing us with. Mark Kennedy from the Wilson Center.
Yeah, Mark, thanks for the question. So on the range piece of this, we really need to understand, again, where's the threat going and what's driving us into these. When I go to this high-low mix, there's going to be some platforms that I think are working inside the highly contested environment where the range piece of this, it's more about survivability of the munition. And then those are going to be on the standout side of this. Range really does become a factor. And as that threat evolves, I think what you're going to see is this growing piece of what range really looks like. Without having the right sort of systems in place, you could have the most excellent long-range munition that you need, but the exquisite nature of that and the cost of that to be able to get it from, you know, 500, 600 miles, whatever the distance is, into its actual target area is going to require a pretty exquisite system of sensors, guidance, fusing, all of that to be able to have the right effect onto the target. I'm not saying that we don't need that. I'm just saying that I think there's a balance between what we need inside that highly contested area and then outside. The last piece of this, I think I'll just riff off of the question a bit, but that is really having the right inventory and supplies of these. I think that's also a big measure of effectiveness on what I'm looking for on the munitions portfolio and the right accounts onto these. It's having the industrial base ready to be able to turn the volume up as we need to make sure that we have the right high-low mix of exquisite and then low-cost munitions on it, more so than just looking at it range-dependent. Thanks for the question.
Okay, how about John Harper?
Great, thank you. Thanks for doing this, General. The Air Force has been testing boost glide hypersonic weapons, and of course, it's also pursuing the air-launched hypersonic cruise missile, the HACM. I was wondering, it seems a little bit unclear at this point whether the Air Force is actually going to pursue the boost glide system. What advantages would the Air Force accrue by having these two different types of hypersonic weapons? How much of a trade-off is there by, only going down one path, with the cruise missiles versus the boost glide? Are there major advantages to having two different types of systems? What are the pros and cons there in your mind?
Yeah, great question. Thanks. So first, hypersonics is an area that we need to continue to put more research and development dollars into. No doubt, they provide a very asymmetric advantage for us in the Air Force. What I won't get into are specifics of an air-launched or the glide vehicles or an air-to-air piece of this. I think a lot of that R&D has to still play out for us to know exactly where we want to be in the hypersonics game. Thanks.
Okay, Steve Trimble.
Yeah, hi, thank you very much. This question is kind of a follow-up on that, but looking at hypersonics from the reusable angle, go back 25 years before B-21, the idea was to have a reusable hypersonic bomber in 2037 or some time frame. Does the Air Force still see a need for that extreme speed, whether crewed or uncrewed, ISR strike in that time period or beyond? Is the greater advantage in something that may be slower but more stealthy, that sort of thing?
So I would tell you that yes, the Air Force is still interested in hypersonic and in the value proposition that hypersonics add to what we need into this threat environment. To your other point of this, remember we talked earlier about the high-low mix of, hey, there's some things that can be slower Mach, but have more survivability, or they provide a different purpose when it comes to pairings of munitions and what we would want to see as the desired effect. But hypersonics and the speed that they provide is another asymmetric advantage. I would tell you that the more that we need to put into this and the more that other countries invest into this as well, it becomes less and less of an asymmetric advantage. But I do think that speed brings a value all in of itself and when you would want to use it. It's not the one-hit wonder weapon that we need, but even looking at reusable pieces of this is something that's absolutely an area that we need to continue to further develop. Good question. Thank you.
Okay, Mike Fantini.
Hey, General Harris. General Deptula, thanks so much for doing this and your continued service. My question is towards ABMS and Joint All Domain Command and Control. Can you talk about, the integration across the services where ABMS, Overwatch, and Convergence are coming together and what's going on in that realm? Thanks.
Man, good to hear from you. So yes, I can. I was just out at Camp Pendleton at Project Convergence, the fourth iteration of this. And what was really encouraging for me to see is it was Army, Marines, and Air Force there all bringing this. And from your past experience, there's an aspect of Project Convergence that works bottom up. It's the emergent piece of this, where they start taking segments of the infrastructure to try to connect them together, versus the ABMS approach, which actually looks at an architecture systems point of view and starts being able to figure out what things are we going to modernize or what things do we actually need to start connecting at a larger scale, and then bring that down. And the art of this is making sure that Project Convergence and ABMS kind of meet in the middle at the right time and place. So having multiple services put in money or dollars into this is actually really helpful. I would offer that probably the next thing that's needed is probably more of a joint look into it when you start looking at JADC2 and you almost have an executive steering group that comes together to make sure that you can take a look at the Army's plan, the Navy's plan, and the Air Force's plan to make sure that, you know, are we all investing in the same thing, or are we investing in different things, but they're all connected in meaningful ways? That's probably the next step that we need to go to. But the work that the Army's doing on Project Convergence has been great. And just to give a shout out to Luke Cropsey, he has really jump-started. He and Flack Clayton have jump-started this process. And as you know from the work there, I mean, we laid the groundwork and the foundation for them to finally start getting up onto speed and start being able to deliver capability in the ABMS domain on this one. So thanks for your hard work into that.
All right, let's shift to a couple. We got a couple of really good questions in the chat room. This one's from Jay Fry. Did the Air Force is the Air Force learning anything from the recent Marine Corps force design efforts?
We are. So I had an opportunity before I got into the seat as Air Force Futures to talk to General Berger. You know, what's interesting, one of the things he regrets is that he should have never put a date on his force design, the force design 2030.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes what it does is it gives you the illusion that, hey, at 2030, my force is complete and it is built and I am good to go. When really, in practice, what we find is it's an evolving piece of this. Because I think we're migrating away from a capabilities-based approach to a threat-based approach. So as that threat changes, so too does the force design piece of this. So that is one thing that we took away. The other part of it, internally, I would say that I probably should have taken some more marketing classes in college, because my ability to be able to speak to what that force design is and be able to articulate that to Congress and our senior leaders, as well as our joint leaders that are out there, is crucial. It is absolutely critical, because there's pieces in the Marine Corps force design that as they divest, that becomes a bill for other services to pick up. Or we have to look at it holistically as a joint force to go, what value and what return on investment do we see this in the future playing out as the threat evolves? So that part of bringing a corporate body together, as well as being able to articulate exactly what's in your force design, are two big pieces we learned from the Marines.
No, that's great. And that also plays into the pragmatic position of, yes, we've been the lowest funded we've ever been relative to the other services out there for 30 plus years, but we also have to deal with the top line that we're dealt. All the services to a degree have the same sort of resource challenges.
That's right.
Not as difficult as the Air Force, I would suggest, but so that calls for a better articulation and cross-cutting look and evaluation at capabilities. This kind of goes back to the cost per effect.
That's right.
And doing evaluation across all of the services, not just within the stovepipes of each one of the services.
So can I add on to that?
Yeah, we just need to, my point is we just need to keep on hammering that point home.
Amen. So we do. The other part of this, though, and I think it's part of the same discussion when I talked about not the marketing piece, but the way that we articulate it is, for a long time now over the global war on terror, when we started looking at units and how we deployed and what we deployed in the UTC construct we had, I think going to this deployed combat wing is going to be a way that we can articulate risk better to the joint force. Yeah. And to Congress.
Absolutely.
As well. So having a method in which we can say that we lack capacity in these areas to be able to put this number of deployed combat wings forward is going to be pretty powerful.
Yeah, no, I agree 1,000%. Here's a good one from Dave Babcock. You mentioned several times today that we need more people. What general skill sets besides pilots do we need the most to meet the GPC threat now and in the future? That's question one. Let you answer that one first before I load you up with question
two. Yeah, thanks. So if I did say that I agree, we do need more people. I didn't realize that I actually said it as much as I think I did. So I would tell you that on the people side of the house, yes, we still have a deficit in the pilot production. But more importantly on this, there's a deficiency in the number of security forces that we have in defenders and civil engineers and other agile combat support personnel writ large. And I really think that it's really getting that back into balance so we have the right capabilities in a deployable combat wing, as well as the right capabilities in a base command structure for them to both effectively do their job. So that's an area that the A1, Lieutenant General Caroline Miller, is looking at in depth to make sure that we have the right balance. Good question. Thanks.
Yeah, here's Dave's question, or part two. Will collaborative combat aircraft decrease the requirements for other weapon systems needed in the future, and what impact will that have on our limited resources, both airmen and financially?
So that's a pretty broad question. To answer to answer the whole question, I guess my answer is I don't know yet. That work is still ongoing. To go more specifically into this, I think what we're going to see with collaborative combat aircraft is that this is going to be an event-driven learning journey as we go on. I couldn't think of the right word for it. But as we look at all of this coming together, and I think when you get the first increment out the door to be able to see how we're going to use it, we'll better understand. There could be different AFSCs that we need to be able to pull. How do you pull data off of an unmanned platform in a real-time fashion? So you're part data analyst, you're part intel, but you're also part mechanic or part intel officer, or part pilot onto this as well. So all of these things are being fused together because I think there is a convergence of AFSCs that may end up happening to be able to effectively employ these CCAs. And that's something I think through experimental operations that we can actually test this out and see what we need.
Okay, let's switch back to some of our raised hands and go with Kevin Antcliffe. Kevin?
Good morning. Really appreciate the conversation this morning. Kevin Antcliffe, X-Wing, which is a company developing uncrewed logistics aircraft. And really appreciate the focused on next-gen air logistics, mentioned needing to get to the right solution that's effective. How do you really see uncrewed aircraft platforms, maybe that are smaller than a C-130, playing into this solution in the Pacific?
So I guess it depends. Great question. I guess it depends on the types of platforms we're talking about and where in the Pacific we're using them. I think there's a certain area, if you're trying to use them in a contested environment, the things I think about are the attributes of the force design. And there's one that's a connectedness piece and how they're connecting along a grid to be able to provide information back as well as moving logistics. But the other part of this is survivability. You can have one type of platform that's going to be more out of the threat envelope, and you have other ones that need to operate a little bit closer in. So the survivability aspect is going to be critically important. And then lastly, we talked a lot about ABMS and being able to connect into that architecture so we know exactly where it's at any given time to be able to get logistics to the point of need when we need it. And that piece, we're still going to have to continue to study and look at what is the most effective way to have those resilient comm pathways together in that architecture and to deliver the logistics piece of it. I don't think it's just a one system, one type of platform. I think there's going to have to be multiple things to come together in order for us to be effective in that environment. Great question. Thanks.
Okay, back to the chat Q&As. Here's an interesting one from Andrew Rowan. If we're going to rely on innovative spirit to offset capacity to win a great power war, how does that change the acceptable level of risk for a CFAC? We all know that a lower force ratio increases risk. Is U.S. deterrence less credible if everyone knows that the CFAC will have to accept a higher acceptable level of risk?
So good point. If I said before that I'm relying on the innovative spirit to offset capacity, then I've not articulated myself well. So I would say that I think that the innovative spirit is always needed in where we're at. And the reason why I would say this is just looking back into history, that the force that we went into World War II with, I mean, the B-17, I believe, was a coastal defense platform that we then changed to what we needed as a part of a strategic bombing campaign. So as you look to see what we're going to do with the force, I think that there is a force that you go to war with. There's an innovative spirit aspect of this in order to transpose what that force needs to look like during conflict. And this, again, gets back to the heart of industry, and that is their ability to be able to work with the Air Force in times of crisis to be able to rapidly generate the capabilities we need. I would say that there's always a tension. I'm going to take this. The Vice Chief has used this analogy quite often. But there's often three things that are in tension that we have to balance. One is growing requirements. Another one is resources. And then the other one is risk. And we often tend to just put a pin into the resource piece. We increase requirements, therefore we increase risk. Or, you know, if we can actually get some dollars to this, you can increase requirements, you can fix risk by adding more money to it. So there's those three things that are always in tension, and you have to work through all of it. I think that similar trinity effect happens within the innovative spirit, the force that you go to war with, and the force that you're going to need as you actually enter conflict. Those are three different things. So how does it affect the CFAC? I think early it affects his risk decision and what he wants to do based on the force that he has to go to war with. But he also has to articulate where the gaps are, where the growing requirements are, in order for all of us, both at the Pentagon and in industry, to be able to take those and develop the next capabilities.
Okay, let's go back to Live and John Harper again. John?
Great, thank you. There's been a lot of attention lately on ground-launched loitering munitions, given everything going on in Ukraine and the Middle East. But from an Air Force perspective, I was wondering if you think that, you know, within the next 5 to 10 years or so, that air-launched loitering munitions will be a significant part of the Air Force's weapons inventory, or if you don't necessarily see that type of weapon playing a big role in what you all are doing.
Good question. So we've experimented with some of the air loitering pieces of this and some of the wargaming functions we've done to see what type of return on investment and what type of situation would we really find loitering weapons to be effective against and how we would use them. There is a case to be made in my mind about the loitering weapons piece of this, but I don't think it trumps the need of some of the other munitions in the portfolio right now as far as some of your more exquisite, higher capability, higher end weapons, the more precision and accurate weapons that are out there, as well as the need to be able to rapidly develop the low cost munitions that are out there. So just with those two alone, I think that we've got enough problem set within the budget area that we need to kind of take a look at both of those. The loitering piece of this, you know, the interesting part is if you do have some of these lower cost munitions, if they're modular in nature, how we can then swap parts of this out to rapidly innovate to get to a point where at some point in time in a conflict, if I do need them to loiter, I could actually have them loiter and connected into the right network.
Okay, very good. I'm going to go back to someone who's been patiently waiting, but all I've got here is Douglas. So Douglas, with your hand up, over to you.
All right. Good morning, gentlemen. Doug Kuhn from Genghis Leadership Strategies. Mitchell Institute sponsored the Space Power Security Forum last month, where Space Force discussed their stand-up of the Space Force Futures. General, how do you see the interplay between Air Force Futures and the upcoming Space Force Futures? Over.
Yeah, great question, and thanks for that one. So we actually, it's quite a good partnership right now. The way that SWAC and the A57 or Air Force Futures interacts today is actually a really good touch point, and we have close collaboration with them. We work well with their team. I would tell you that one of the ways that we kind of talk back and forth to make sure that we stay connected is through the idea of these mission threads. What is it that space needs to do? What is it that air needs to do? And there's connective tissue between the two of these. So within that trade space of these mission threads and how we talk back and forth, it's written in the same language. We can import theirs, they can import ours. And you actually collaboratively then go back and build a department of the Air Force that you need. I think that some of the changes that I would like to see come out of the great power competition reoptimization piece of this is actually then now at the secretariat level to make sure that as Space Force begins to build out what they need for the future and the Air Force builds out what it needs for the future, that both of them come up to the secretariat level and they're connected. Not only that, but they're prioritized just based on the realities of funding, that you have to make sure that the Space Force isn't investing in areas that the Air Force needs and vice versa, that the Air Force isn't investing in things that the Space Force is counting on. So pulling those together is going to be really helpful. So I'm really excited for Space Force Futures and where it's going to go, but that partnership needs to continue. Thanks for the question.
Here's a good one from an old friend, Larry McGee. ABMS as a unifying connectivity transport tissue is underway. When does ABMS move beyond connectivity transport to unifying data and or applications such as C2, ISR, and targeting?
To the broader question, I'm not sure of what that end state is. As a matter of fact, I would posit that this will continue. We are going to chip away at this problem over time. And the reason why I say that is because of data structures that are out there. Some services have already taken the bite at the apple. It said that, hey, we're going to have a certain set data architecture that's out there. And then over time, you can build to that. But I guess the question would be, how do you then port in the current legacy systems or the current systems you have into this new data architecture. That's always been the tension. I just think it's something that you're going to have to work over time to be able to migrate to get to. I think the way that you actually do that is with some of the efforts that are underway right now with the great power competition reoptimization. We talked about the stand-up of a new integrated capabilities command. That'll be one place that we can start looking horizontally at all the platform systems and modernization that's out there to make sure that we're going to be connected in a meaningful way that actually takes the ABMS architecture and overlays it into where we want to go into the future.
Very good. Here's one from Jack Smith. Talk to us a bit about attack density. With the air fleet at record small levels and standoff driving high cost, how do we sustainably strike a high volume of targets in a great power competition campaign necessary to collapse their enterprise?
Over time, it would be my... It's a valid point. As fleets begin to draw down, or as the weapon system sustainment or procurement of new platforms is less, you're going to have less to be able to put onto that target. And I would tell you that it's really, to me, as I think through the problem set, it's about the number of rails that are out there and what munitions go onto those rails. So just because I'm drawing down a fleet, if I have the capability with other platforms of putting more munitions onto them, then I think that's another winning proposition. But really, we're getting into different trade spaces. I would love to be able to have more of those platforms and more of those rails to be able to do exactly what he's saying. So instead of actually pulsing operations in, I get to almost a near continuous piece of putting applied pressure onto the enemy, whether it's through kinetic or non-kinetic means.
Actually, that takes me back 33 years to the planning of Desert Storm. And in fact, that was one of the pieces that we used when we were doing the original plan design. And that's not just, you know, big pulse up front, but continuous application of force across 24-hour periods,
right,
to make it unrelenting. And that's where the capacity piece obviously becomes a player.
So your capacity piece, it's that continuous piece gets smaller and smaller the less you have. You would like to see that grow to a point where it's actually credible continuous presence.
Great point. Here's one from Michael Dom. You've spoken about our strategies needing to be threat informed. What are the types of emerging threats that concern Air Force futures the most? What are the greatest potential gaps that we need to close with adversaries like China and Russia?
So growing threats, I think, the way that we use artificial intelligence right now as a force multiplier, I'm not certain that the adversary sees artificial intelligence in the same way, by way of what are they going to discriminate by way of friendly or foe? And then how does that come to pass on the capacity of aircraft and threats that they can bring to bear? So if you put AI combined with the capacity and numbers of aircraft that they have, that's a problem set. The other one is where we're going in space. And I would tell you the other piece of this is the growing munitions and long-range ballistic missile threats that continue to pose, like you said in your question, threats to our ability to stage and base out of different places. All of those together. And then, quite frankly, the last one, and we're seeing it today, is a lot of the cyber activity that's out there.
Very good. Here's one from Lieutenant General retired John Fairfield. Can you please address communications requirements when you address mobility in the context of mobility? We assume deployable comms are available, but it doesn't appear that we have the same numbers that we used to in the past.
And I think he's right with that it's not just the deployable comms. I think it's what are you using the comm for? And it's really movement of data. Movement of targeting and relevant data from the forward edge to where you need to have a theater commander or a joint force commander make a decision about the prioritization of targets. So I think that there needs to be, in lieu of ABMS being fully realized, but an architecture that's put into place that I think the MAF, quite frankly, is actually well postured for, to be able to help with the movement of that data back and forth. So it's not just about putting comm suites on to make sure that I've got Nipper and Sipper and VOSIP, but I also need to make sure that I have the right apertures on these planes to be able to move data in a very comm denied environment, but in a very secure way.
Okay, here's a related one from Doug Greenlaw. General, how do you see the Air Force and Department of Defense as a whole? Wait a second. I jumped my question. How do you see allies in the design and implementation of ABMS in our future architecture?
Yeah, great, great question. So first off, more broadly on allies and partners into this is that, you know, when it came to the concept for ACE for me, it wasn't one where, you know, just through the innovative spirit of our airmen, we actually looked toward the allies and partners, in this case, Sweden and Finland, and saw how they actually looked at the Russian threat and what they did with it. And then we were able to kind of take that and make it the way that we need it. When we look at what the United Kingdom is doing and some of the C2 and their dispersed C2 methods, there's a lot to be learned there. And when we look at what Australia is doing in the proximity of that area of the Indo-PACOM area, you know, it's not just having a hubris that the U.S. can go in there and dominate at our time and place of choosing. It's understanding the battlefield and the geopolitical context, and you know, the information that can be passed to you by the allies and partners of, hey, that's common commercial fishing traffic, and that is not common fishing traffic. That's different. Same thing with aircraft that are in the area. So I think what they do is they bring a context that we don't have. They also bring capabilities and strengths into the portfolio. I will tell you the challenge is how do you connect to them in a meaningful way, not only in the data movement that we just talked about, but in a security environment as well.
Excellent. Boy, we're getting close on time and we got a bunch more questions, but which indicates the interest in what you're all about and what you're doing. But here's one from Aiden Poling. The Air Force spent the last 30 years developing plans to modernize its force with types like the F-35, B-21, KC-46, T-7, Sentinel, and so on. The budget caps combined with insufficient Air Force TOA are really limiting the ability to surge production at the rates necessary to backfill the aircraft that are aging out. That said, given the sunk cost and the need for solutions today, those are the options. How do we balance procurement with the continued high investment requirements that will pay off in the future with research and development?
Yeah, what we're seeing, quite frankly, is a reduction in procurement because of this, right? I think there's probably a history piece of this as well. Maybe not answering the question directly, and I apologize, but there's a history element to this as well, and that is, you know, you invest in RDT&E before any major conflict, and then that RDT&E you can pull off the shelf to be able to, the assumption here is you can rapidly procure that when needed. And we saw that within World War I, and then the drawdown, you know, in the interwar years, we put more money into RDT&E. And then as World War II built up, we started doing more of the rapid procurement, pulling that RDT off the shelf to be able to build the next level of innovation and capability. So that cycle continues right up until we hit GWAT. With GWAT, what we did is we put contracts in place. We put contracts in place for ISR. We put contracts in place for intelligence. And then at the end of GWAT, when it was declared over, we cut contracts. So we were still left with a legacy force that we had to modernize, and we were still left with a smaller top line in which to do it under. So the RDT&E dollars become that much more precious in my mind to make sure that we're using them in the right areas. So if conflict does happen again, we can take those same plans and developmental ideas and put them into action through industry.
Very good. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more. It's a pretty good one. You'll hear it here from Andrew Rowan. Regarding base defense and defense of U.S. forces, do you distinguish between classes of UAVs the Air Force should have responsibility for defending against? U.S. air superiority fighters defending against Class 5 UAVs makes sense, but should we be responsible for defending bases and ground forces against lower classes of small UAVs? We've never considered surface-to-surface fires like artillery or mortars a threat to air superiority, but some now consider small UAVs a threat to air superiority. Where do you draw the line?
So where do I draw the line? You know, it's an interesting question because, Dave, I'll tell you quite frankly, I draw the line at loss of human life, and I'm going to put my old DC FAC hat back on. And that is, no, I didn't make a distinguish between, class one or class five, right? What I tell you is whatever sensor could find this thing the first and whatever effect I could put on it the quickest that actually had the best payoff to save a human life, I did.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, this is a long discussion because it does involve excuse me, cross service roles and responsibilities as well. And particularly down there at the smaller end, you go, okay, that discussion does need it, be had, because yes. there absolutely is a resource bill that goes along.
100% agree. But I'll tell you, with the tactical edge, you know, we lost some soldiers at Tower 22 that when you're in combat, what I care about is the loss of life and preserving that life, and whatever was best suited to do it, we used it.
Yeah, which gets us into the back to the directed energy piece for some of these small and close-in systems that has been given proven good potential, particularly in areas where you have good weather, but then you have the weather issue.
So, you know, you keep looking at the effector, as did I. It's really the detection of those things that we need to also invest in and finding them further out.
It's the entire enterprise.
That's right.
Well, and frankly, it's killing them before they get the opportunity to launch.
There you go. I agree with that too.
Absolutely. Okay. All comes back to offensive counter air. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of this Aerospace Nation. Thanks again, General Harris, for taking the time. Great discussion. And from all of us here at Mitchell Institute, we wish you have a great aerospace power kind of day.
Hey, thanks for having me. This was fun.
Take care.
Take care.